Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the economic hostage crisis situation in Washington, D.C., where Republicans are using the threat of economic collapse to extort concessions from a president who has to run for re-election on a weak economy they are weakening further. Former chief investigator for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee and a 20-year columnist for Business Week, Robert Kuttner, joins us to discuss his latest article in the Huffington Post, The End Game, Saving Obama from Himself. Then, with General Petraeus' departure from Afghanistan to head up the CIA, we'll look into whether or not the Petraeus surge was a success, since it depends on political stability and the quality of the Afghan army. Former Afghan analyst at the State Department Bureau of Intelligence and Research, Dr. Marvin Weinbaum, joins us to discuss the recent series of assassinations, including Karzai's brother Wali, that indicate less stability and more success for the Taliban as a drawdown of U.S. troops begins. Then we'll talk about the unexpected and unintended consequences of the so-called Carmageddon hysteria that predicted gridlock, but instead delivered a calm and clean Los Angeles where you could breathe, you could hear the birds and not the traffic, where you could breathe fresh air and where Angelenos relaxed at home with their families. Maybe we should demolish freeway bridges more often. The godfather of the slow movement, Carl Honoré, joins us. He is the author of In Praise of Slowness, How a Worldwide Movement is Challenging the Cult of Speed. I'm now joined by Robert Kuttner, who's a co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. Robert Kuttner is the author of 8 books, including his latest, A Presidency in Peril, the insider story of Obama's promise, Wall Street's power, and the struggle to control our economic future. He has an article on the Huffington Post right now titled The End Game, Saving Obama from Himself. Thank you for joining us on Background Briefing, Robert Kuttner.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
And congratulations
on Carmageddon.
Well, I had nothing to do with it, but I sure enjoyed it. And I think there's a lesson to be learned from...
Indeed.
Your position, though, with this what I refer to as this... economic hostage crisis going on in Washington, D.C., is that the worst thing that could happen is that the Republicans could have a sanity transplant and then agree to what Obama proffered and offered on the table.
Yeah, the only thing, well, as I say in the piece, I mean, there's two things saving him from his own worst instincts to capitulate. One is the fact that the Republicans are too crazy to take the deal. And the other is that the Democratic rank and file in Congress are actually pretty good on this. They understand that Social Security and Medicare are crown jewels, that if Social Security needs some fine-tuning and Medicare needs to be converted into a real national health insurance program, you shouldn't get that all mixed up with a budget crisis that is the result of one part the Bush tax cuts and the Bush military buildup and the other part the result of the recession itself. The two have almost nothing to do with each other. Keep them separate. And, you know, Obama keeps throwing the furniture onto the pyre in the hope that the Republicans will take him up on this. And the Republicans are too crazy to do it.
So, there's a rumor, though. I mean, first of all, I don't know how hard the facts are about what he offered on the table. There's a talk of a $4 trillion deal. We know that Boehner agreed to end the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy, which would add at best $1 billion. So even if that's true, it's a 3-to-1 ratio of giving cuts to revenues.
I'm not sure Boehner agreed to end the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy. I mean, Boehner did say that you could have some degree of revenue produced mainly by closing tax loopholes. But the point is, any talk on the part of Boehner's part about any revenue increases is enough to get the Tea Party people and the freshmen to unhorse him as speaker. So no sooner had Boehner tentatively agreed to some of this than he was almost lynched by his own caucus.
Well, but what we hear, though, is that the president is, and he, as you point out in your article in the Huffington Post, Robert Kuttner, is that the president's positioning himself as the adult in the room. Now, maybe, you know, if this stuff's off the table, we can breathe a sigh of relief. If that's the price for winning over the center, so be it. But there's no evidence in polling that the American people really get it. I mean, this is perhaps a product of our collapsing education system, that it's about 50-50, that 50% of people think that that the U.S. defaulting is will be a disaster, and the other 50% think it's okay.
Well, you know, but that's only as an abstraction, you know? I mean, what happens when interest rates go up and the stock market falls by 1,000 points? So you can't trust the polls on this kind of thing. The essence of leadership is not being led yourself by the polls. You know, and the Republicans are going to bring up this Cap, Cut, and Balance Act tomorrow before the House that would cost about 700,000 jobs. It would dramatically cut Medicare and Medicaid. It would require the federal budget to be capped at 18% of GDP, even in a recession. And the Ryan budget plan, which scared off a lot of Republican elected officials, is too moderate to meet the criteria of this proposal. So when the House Republicans pass this thing, they are giving the Democrats all kinds of ammunition for next year if Obama doesn't go them one better with his own offer of cuts in Social Security and Medicare. So, I mean, I think the Republicans have backed themselves into a corner. Because if the economy really is on the edge of default, and you have the Republicans' normal allies on Wall Street and CEOs of corporations telling them you can't do this, you can't let the United States of America go into default, the Republicans are going to have to blink first. We got a preview of that with Mitch McConnell's program. If Obama just hangs tough,
well. Obviously, I don't see where the leverage is, frankly, in the idea is that Obama's strategy is to pin this on the Republicans and let them go ahead and pull the House down. But even there, that's a Pyrrhic victory, surely, because if they do the crazy thing, the election's a year away, and probably by then the people will be so in such stress they'll blame Obama at any rate. So I guess the question is, how suicidal are the Republicans?
Well, I think at the end of the day, we're not going to have a default. I mean, I think enough Wall Street people are going to get to enough Republican members of Congress that they'll figure out a way to paper this over. I think it's going to look something like the Mitch McConnell plan, where Obama is given the authority to increase the debt ceiling, and the number they're talking about for 10-year budget cuts is in the order of $1.5 trillion, which is a lot less than $4 trillion, and that gives the House Republicans something that they can claim victory about. And my guess is that the deal we're going to see is going to be much like the McConnell plan. I mean, the Republicans in the House are going to vote for this extreme, draconian cut, cap, and balance act. The Senate's going to refuse to pass it, and then Harry Reid, the Democratic leader, Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, are going to cut a deal that the Senate is going to pass first, giving Obama the right to unilaterally increase the debt ceiling with some gimmies for Republicans. There may be a deficit reduction commission. There may be some cuts attached to it, and then they're going to send it back to the House, and then corporate America is going to go into action. I mean, it's very interesting. The Republican Party is squeezed between the complete crazies of the Tea Party and the business elite. And
but surely that doesn't make any sense then for the president to let them off the hook if they are if they are squeezed, as you say, and the Mitch McConnell deal that you're talking about, that gets the Republicans off the hook because the president takes the heat for raising the debt ceiling, and then they want to come back to him every other week and extract more concessions and keep playing this game of threatening this insane idea of pulling the House down. I mean,
well, the version of it that's being talked about is he's got to come back to them three times between now and the election. So I mean, I don't, you know, the flip side of the public not, 50% of the public not caring if the United States of America defaults, is that at least 70% of the public could not care less about the arcane details of how the debt ceiling is raised. I mean, people care about jobs, people care about their income, people care about their health insurance, people care about whether they're going to lose their homes. And a lot of this stuff is an inside baseball, Washington Beltway media game. There's a real economy out there. Real people are hurting. And the 2012 election is not going to turn on whether, you know, Obama brought us budget balance by 2021. It's going to turn on whether the unemployment rate is coming down.
Well, but at this point, I don't see the broad public and the press reporting the obvious, or at least understanding the obvious, that this economic hostage crisis situation in Washington is because the Republicans are using the threat of economic collapse to extort concessions from a president who has to run for re-election on a weak economy that they are weakening further. So that, well, to me, is the dynamic, that the Democrats get blamed for the wreckage and the Republicans are the wrecking crew.
Right, exactly. And you're right that the mainstream media are not reporting that, and that's why we have Pacifica and the American Prospect.
Well, I wish there were more people listening to us, Robert Gartner. That's all I can say, because I don't think you have to be an Einstein to figure this out. It's pretty flagrant, isn't it, this extortion?
Yeah, sure. Although I'd like to think that you and I are pretty smart fellows.
Well, you know, it's a joke, but there's an awful lot at stake. And what I don't understand, let's not even talk about the president's negotiating tactics, because we don't really know the details. But so far, they don't look too good. But if the president is, what he did say in his press conference recently struck me was that, let's get this big deal over with, and then we can get back to the real work of creating jobs. Well, I would have thought it should have been the other way around. Don't buy into the deficit hoax. Don't have your commission paid for by Pete Peterson and the Wall Street billionaires.
Right.
Talk about jobs from day one, and then forget all this other nonsense, because how come you've allowed yourself to tie the economy to the debt?
Exactly. No, I couldn't agree more. There is a cartoon out by Tom Tomorrow called Middleman, which is the best single thing I've seen on this, where he's got Obama just being taken to the cleaners by the Republicans again and again and again, and just not learning. So it's really very unfortunate, and I think the Democrats and the independents who elected Obama and the Democrats in the House and the Senate just need to hold his feet to the fire, so that if he comes up with a deal that gives away the store, no Democrat should vote for it.
Well, but you argue in your article, Robert Kuttner, in the current, on the front page of the Huffington Post, the end game, saving Obama from himself, that Pelosi and others have been weighing in, telling him that.
Yes, they have.
But what about Harry Reid? What he's doing? It sounds like Harry Reid's enabling this McConnell to get off the hook.
Well, but Harry Reid's been very good too. I mean, Harry Reid's been terrific, saying we don't need to touch Social Security and Medicare to do this budget deal. So, I mean, I think you know, politics is the art of the possible, and right now, some version of the McConnell deal is what's possible. So I don't fault Harry Reid for trying to negotiate something with McConnell, because it's rather better than the alternative.
But you don't think that the fact that these pillars of the Democratic Party's legacy, Social Security and Medicare, the very fact that they may well have been put on the table will come back to haunt the Democrats? Do you think they're safely off the table?
No, I don't think they're safely off the table, but they'll only come back to haunt the Democrats if Obama decides to go along with a cut. I mean, he should be screaming from the housetops about how crazy and irresponsible the Republicans are, how the Republicans want to cut your Social Security and your Medicare, how the Republicans are willing to take the economy off the cliff. And, of course, if he gives away some of Social Security and Medicare himself, he denies the Democrats their most potent talking point.
And do you think that the Democratic party? Don't they understand the old adage from the Clinton days? It's the economy, stupid.
Well, I think certainly most of the Democratic caucus in the House and the Senate do understand that. And Obama and his pollsters and his advisors have somehow gotten it into their heads that the key to his election is to be able to stand up and say, I balanced the budget in 2021. Well, who gives a rip? I mean, you have to be, you know, a terminal policy wonk to think that that's more important than reducing the unemployment rate and putting people back to work. So if he doesn't have the wit to understand that, then the Democrats in the House and the Senate and the base organizations who helped put this guy in office need to let him know that if he keeps talking that line, people should spend their efforts next year electing progressives to the House and the Senate, and good luck to Obama. I mean, I'm not quite there, but I'm almost at the point where, you know, if you look at the alternatives for 2012, it's going to be very, very difficult to hold the Senate for the Democrats just because of the arithmetic. You've got 11 Republican seats being defended. You've got 23 Democratic seats being defended, including the class of 06, which was the most heavily Democratic class in recent years. So the Democrats are very likely to lose the Senate. Unless Obama has big coattails, it's going to be very hard for the Democrats to take back the House. And given the talk he's talking, he's not going to have coattails at all. So in 2012, after the election, you could very well have Obama squeak through as president and have both houses controlled by the Republicans. And then you have four more years of this insanity. So, you know, there's a part of me that says, God, if we got a Republican president in everything but name, maybe we'd be better off actually having a Republican president, and then the Democrats might be able to take that back their party and run a progressive in 2016. I'm not quite there yet, but six more months of this, and I might be.
So just in closing then, Robert Cutner, do you think anybody's going to point out the obvious? I remember having a conversation with Maya McGuinness about this some time back, suggesting that the Republicans actually have an investment in wrecking the economy and letting the Democrats run on the wreckage. She was very offended by that idea. But that, after all, that's what Mitch McConnell said. His priority is to destroy Obama. He said it again to Laura Ingraham the other day. And what they're doing is exactly that. So why not say it as it is to the American people? Do you think the American people would care, would get it? I mean, it seems like irresponsible behavior that you would hurt everybody in order for you guys to get elected.
Yeah, I think Obama needs to be saying that. I think he needs to be saying it loud and clear, because you're right. The Republicans win both ways. Either they compel Obama to throw the crown jewels of the Democratic legacy into the fire, and then the Republicans can campaign in 2012 saying, hey, the Democrats threw away your Social Security and Medicare, or the Republicans can exact such draconian terms that they deny Obama any fiscal resources to put into jobs, and they can force him to run on a terrible economy. So, you know, unless Obama plays it much more firmly and calls them out on this stuff, they win either way.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Robert Cutner.
Always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Cutner, who's a co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. He's the author of 8 books, including the latest, A Presidency in Peril, The Insider Story of Obama's Promise, Wall Street's Power, and The Struggle to Control Our Economic Future. He also has an article on the Huffington Post right now titled The Endgame, Saving Obama from Himself. Let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about Petraeus leaving Afghanistan and what he's leaving behind. Every day I find a war against the mirror. I can't take the person staring back at me. I'm a hazard to myself. Don't let me get me. I'm my own worst enemy. It's about what you would know yourself. So irritating. Don't want to be my friend no more. I want to be somebody. Muslim. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining me now is Dr. Marvin Weinbaum, who was the former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the State Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the United States Department of State from 1991 to 2003. He was a senior fellow at the United States Institute for Peace and held Fulbright research fellowships for Afghanistan and Egypt. Marvin Weinbaum is an emeritus professor at the University of Illinois, where he directs the program in South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. He has authored numerous books, including The Future of Afghanistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marvin Weinbaum.
Hello there.
And General Petraeus departing and handing over Afghanistan to General John Allen, who warns of tough days ahead. Nevertheless, General Petraeus has basically said in an interview on NATO television that things are going well in Afghanistan, and his surge strategy, which was employed in Iraq, has generally borne fruit. How do you feel about that, given the recent rash of assassinations?
Well, he does qualify that always by noting that it is fragile, and it's yet to be demonstrated that the Afghans will step up and do their part. So it's tentative. Naturally, as he hands over command, he wants to put the best face on what has been accomplished in the time that he's been there, along with his predecessor, General McChrystal. And he can point to the fact that in the south, in two critical provinces in the south, Helmand and Kandahar, there's clearly been progress made in a military sense. So it's mixed, obviously.
Well, it seems though that just in the last couple of days, the Taliban have struck. They've killed three NATO soldiers in the east of the country, and seven Afghan police officers were killed in a district in Helmand that is due to be handed over to the Afghan army tomorrow.
Yes. Well, I think we have to distinguish here between progress, generally speaking, on the ground, which means that you've secured areas, life goes on more normally than it has for a long time, and a sense here about who controls these broad areas. Distinguish this from the ability of any terrorist group, any group operating as a guerrilla outfit, to strike against individuals and to do so with a very clear objective of really trying to affect people's perception. It doesn't demonstrate that they have made great progress, but only that they are capable of taking advantage of security breaches. So we can't underestimate what they're doing and the importance of it, because it does have an impact, but it doesn't negate Petraeus's portrayal of what's happened in the South. And in general, there have been fewer attacks this year than there were for period last year, although casualties certainly among civilians have been higher.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Marvin Weinbaum, who was the former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the United States Department of State. Now, of course, the assassination of Karzai's half-brother, Wali, in Kandahar, led to a lot of speculation that things weren't going that well. But I think in many ways, the more recent assassination of Karzai's close aide, Jan Mohammad Khan, who was killed in Kabul, would indicate, I think, a worse situation, wouldn't it?
Well, I think both of them, again, show that the kind of security that's going to protect individuals is just not there. There's no question that what the Taliban are doing is that they are targeting high-level people in the government. This, again, is attempting here to affect the thinking of people that no place is secure. I would also stress that the killing of Karzai's half-brother is important, but for a somewhat different reason, in that he was critical in the plans for the stabilization of that south, particularly the Kandahar region, because here's a strong guy who was able to bring his own security personnel to work along with the Allied forces. And with his death, the feeling is that there is not going to be a strongman replacement like this. It's going to be up for grabs, and that's a cause for some concern. So I would say among all the developments that have taken place, that's the most serious one.
But Dr. Meinbaum, surely, though, when you said that the Taliban are employing a strategy of assassinating important officials in what would be the Afghan government or the army and the police that would take over after NATO and the U.S. Withdraw, that's not to say, though, that Wali Karzai was killed by the Taliban.
Well, we don't know that. That's uncertain. The man who killed him, who was a close associate, it was thought that perhaps there was some falling out between them. But there have been some reports that he made trips to Quetta in Pakistan, where he could very well recently, and several of them, where he could very well have been in touch with the Taliban. So that remains somewhat undecided here as to whether he was acting alone or whether he was acting on the behalf of the Taliban.
Well, the Taliban, of course, took credit for the assassination.
Well, yeah, naturally. Well, they'll take credit for everything that will take place. So that's to be understood. They are, they've got their own problems, and I think we shouldn't underestimate those problems. Let me add something else, though, that these attacks are conceivably important for a very different reason. They're sending a message, too, and that message is one that we don't want to hear, and that is there is no political solution lying out there for us to grasp. We've convinced ourselves that we right now, with the right initiatives, we can bring them to the negotiating table. By what they're doing now, rather than building confidence in a compromise, they're in effect snubbing us. They're saying, "Well, this is this is what we think," and surely what it means is that we think we can win, and there's no reason to compromise. And so I think that's a bad sign here. If we thought that they were seriously considering some political arrangement with the Kabul government.
So it's that the Taliban expression, "You've got the watches and we've got the time."
They've always had this. What they add to that is, if time is on our side, so is God. And when that's the case, you don't do much compromising.
You've negotiated with the Taliban in the past, right?
Well, what happened in the State Department was that there were serious negotiations with Mullah Omar's Taliban back in the late 90s. It was over then, trying to find some kind of arrangement with their Northern Alliance opposition, which would leave the Northern Alliance in a power-sharing arrangement. Well, that was when they displayed that they really were, in a sense, not an inclusive group. They don't go in for power-sharing. In fact, the very idea that these true believers, and that's what they are going to settle for this ministry and that ministry and that appointment and that appointment, I just don't believe there's anything to suggest that they can see themselves operating in a constitutional vein.
But surely, Dr. Marvin Weinbaum, that is exactly the situation that we are going to be presenting as the future as we pull out, as the military efforts diminish, which they are beginning to happen now. we're going to be trying to get, and we are trying to get Karzai and company to negotiate with the Taliban, and we'll end up with the same situation. We have the
what we really are hoping for in the Petraeus approach is not the grand bargain. It's the idea of reintegration. If you can succeed militarily, and that's a big if because it takes follow through by the Afghans with their own security forces, better development plans in there, which change people's lives, some evidence here of justice being available to them, which it's not now. If you can do all those things, then what you can do is wean away these Taliban elements, because it's a diverse group. You can wean them away, and that ultimately is the strategy. It was not in the Petraeus plan to strike the grand bargain, except if you got them in such a weak position that they found themselves then with no choice but, in effect, to come to the negotiating table.
Well, just in the last minute, Dr. Marvin Weinbaum, since you've also dealt with Pakistan when you're in the State Department Bureau of Intelligence, there's this grim footage out now. I don't know whether you've seen it, of 16 Pakistani police being lined up by the Pakistani Taliban right on the border with Afghanistan and mercilessly mowed down after being lectured by some Taliban psychopath. It's absolutely hideous, but it reminds you that it's the Pakistan military that's bearing the brunt, exactly the very thing that the Pakistanis have been reminding us, as we, of course, have been castigating them for what we consider their duplicity.
Yeah, what we're disturbed about is this, that their efforts, and they have suffered against this, their own Taliban, their efforts against their own Taliban are for their own interests. That is, their Taliban are a threat to the Pakistan state. We're asking them to as well go after the Afghan Taliban, who are a threat to us in inside Afghanistan. And so it's while they are suffering, they're fighting again not in support of us, which we want them to, but in support of their own forces, and they're paying a heavy price for it.
Well, I must say that footage is so grim. It makes wonder whether there could be any, these divisions could ever be healed in that part of the world.
Well, you know, they signed with the Pakistani Taliban in the past. They've signed upwards of 6 agreements. Right. And the Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban, they're a separate group now. They broke every single one of them. And so when we hear about that ultimately, and they have very similar ideology to Afghan Taliban.
Sure. We've run out of time here, I'm afraid. But I thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Marvin Weinbaum. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Marvin Weinbaum, who's a former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the United States Department of State. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how Carmageddon didn't happen, but something quite wonderful did. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining me now is Carl Honoré, author of the book In Praise of Slowness, How a Worldwide Movement is Challenging the Cult of Speed. He has been called the godfather of the slow movement. His most recent book is Under Pressure, Rescuing Our Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting. He also blogs at carlhonoré.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carl Honoré.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
And we had an accidental lesson in the virtues of slowness here this last weekend in Los Angeles, where the much hyped by the local media Carmageddon, as it was labeled, did not materialize. There wasn't giant gridlock and panic and hysteria. In fact, there was quite the opposite. There was a quiet over the city. You could hear the birds. The air was clean. People spent the weekend relaxing with their families. It was altogether a very, very worthwhile and pleasant experience. And my only sense is that we should do this more often. Maybe they should shut the freeways down once a week or once a month.
Well, it's not surprising to hear you describe it that way, because it seems to me that we're now so marinated in this culture of speed. We're all so stuck in fast forward. We're all stuck on this, you know, high-speed treadmill that we're terrified of the idea of slowness. And the notion that we might have to slow down at some point seems like an automatic Armageddon. But the truth of the matter is that actually slowing down for us, you know, slowing down judiciously, not doing everything as slowly as possible, but choosing the right moments to slow down is the surest way to live a healthier, happier, more fulfilled life. And I think it's not surprising that the moral of the story of the Carmageddon is that people actually quite enjoyed it. If you think of, you know, when we're lying on our deathbeds at the end of our days and we look back, you know, nobody lies in their deathbed and thinks, I wish I'd spent more time driving my car, or I wish I'd spent more time at work or shopping. But those are the three things that consume the vast number of our hours. And they're the things that when you're forced to stop driving around and charging about the city like a headless chicken, that you have to let go. And what do you recuperate? What do you rescue when you let that stuff fall by the wayside? You bring back the things that really give life meaning and texture. You know, you spend time with your children. You read them a bedtime story without dashing off to get, you know, to do another errand in the car. Or you have a meal with your family in the garden, a barbecue. Or you just go for a walk, or maybe you just swing in a hammock for a little while. And those things, I think, are where a lot of joy comes from. And it's not surprising that people reconnect with their inner tortoise and enjoy it when the time comes.
Well, but I'm not sure the lesson will be learned, because clearly the local press, who ginned up all this hysteria, and the city of Los Angeles actually enlisted a couple of big celebrities, Tom Hanks and Ashton Kutcher, to help publicize this event. But the local media, of course, is not the last thing they want to take responsibility for is the excessive hype. And frankly, every time it rains here in Los Angeles, the local media refers to a vast storm heading our way, storm watch, Southern California, we have crews out, and all this kind of stuff. So they by nature operate on hyperbole. But how do we get to your lessons and make this not just an accident, but something that we can kind of weave into our daily lives?
Well, I think the sad truth is that often it takes a real shock to the system, or a wake-up call to make people realize that they've got stuck in fast-forward and that it's doing them real harm. And for many people nowadays, that wake-up call comes in the form of an illness. You know, one day the body just throws in the towel and says, I can't take it anymore, and you have a heart attack, or your hair starts to fall out, or you just can't get out of bed one morning, or maybe a relationship goes up in smoke because you haven't had the time or the tranquility to listen to the other person, to be with them. I think that something, I mean, I'm a natural-born optimist, and I think that sometimes these surprising, serendipitous moments like a Carmageddon that force people to slow down, they may resist up front, but they actually start, once they taste some of the fruits of slowness, maybe they go back into the fray when the highways open up again with slightly different spirit, and maybe they don't drive quite so fast, maybe don't drive quite so often. I mean, I think it's a tough one, because obviously the main thrust of our culture is towards acceleration. It's towards doing more and more, faster and faster, in less and less time. But I think more and more people are beginning to wake up to the fact that that's a kind of folly, and that there is a lot to be gained by shifting gears. By it's not about, I'm not a fundamentalist of slowness. I love speed. You know, I live in London, which is a city of volcanic energy. I work in the media and I play hockey. You know, I like fast things. But I guess this slow philosophy, if you wanted to sum it up, is about doing things at what musicians call the tempo giusto, you know, the right speed, that every moment, every act, every person has the right time. And if you do things at the right speed, you do them better and enjoy them more. And I think that, you know, whether it's a Carmageddon or whether it's, you know, gas prices going so high that people can't drive as much, anything that just forces us to, you know, shift our view of the world, to knock us out of that groove and to think of things in a different light, I think can ultimately be helpful, maybe.
Again, I'm speaking with Carl Honoré, who is in London, England. He's the author of In Praise of Slowness, How a Worldwide Movement is Challenging the Cult of Speed. And clearly, though, there's a component in capitalism which calls for more consumption, more, and the consequent resource depletion. Every company has to have better quarterly earnings. People are more and more on a kind of treadmill as a result of the system. And the people who were hurt over this weekend were the retailers and the restaurants. They simply didn't get the same business. And I'm sure that'll be a lot of what the reportage is. So, in other words, family life, ordinary human beings were the winners, but retailers were the losers. Now, is there a way to avoid that?
Well, I think in the short term, if we move to a kind of slow culture, there are going to be winners and losers in the short term, absolutely. But I think that in the long run, it's not a zero-sum game. I mean, I think that I'm not an anti-capitalist. I think that capitalism is the best system that we've got. It's just the form of capitalism that we have at the moment, which I think was a kind of turbo-capitalism, which puts us all on this never-ending hamster wheel of consumption and debt. And it's pretty clear. I mean, look what happened with the financial crisis. The U.S. government, the U.S. is teetering on the brink of an apocalyptic debt meltdown. This model is broken. The late 20th century, early 21st century capitalism is a broken model. And I think the way forward is to try and find a way where we can consume without consuming manically and frantically. So I think that kind of change is difficult. Some are perhaps like Los Angeles, which is so dependent on the car, where people, in order to go out and go to those restaurants and shops and stores that you described, are more likely to need a car than they are, say, in London or Portland, Oregon, or somewhere in Manhattan. But, there's still other ways to get around, to think. I mean, I understand that even in L.A. you're starting to move towards people cycling more. You've got a fantastic climate for it. But these things take time. You can't snap your fingers and change the whole socioeconomic paradigm, sadly. You know, the slow revolution will be slow, inevitably.
Well, what's interesting about, you mentioned bicycles, a bunch of local bicyclists challenged the airliner JetBlue, had a kind of publicity event where they flew people from Long Beach to the San Fernando Valley because the freeway prevented that from happening. And local bicyclists challenged JetBlue that they'd get there quicker, and they did.
Did they?
So it's already happening. But what I think the answer is here, Carl Honoré, again, the author of In Praise of Slowness, How a Worldwide Movement is Challenging the Cult of Speed, is that the solution, in terms of the winners and losers, in terms of people having a better quality of life because they, take some time off, as, by the way, the Europeans do. They have 6 weeks vacation and et cetera. We are much, much more into what you call turbo capitalism here. And I think everybody pays a price in terms of the stress, both within the family and within the workplace. But if in terms of slowness, you also go local, where you shop locally, go to local and support local businesses, wouldn't that be a way around it? In other words, to stay away from the big malls and get more into local, and even at local farmers markets and bartering, these are all possibilities.
They are, and I think the go local movement is very much a strand of what the slow conception of what the future might look like, is getting away from an arrangement where every purchase depends on a whole string of spending, having a car, the insurance, the paying for the gas, churning out pollution, all of this sort of knock-on stuff that comes when we travel great distances to make a simple purchase. And I think there's a great and compelling argument to be made for people for capitalism, both in the United States and Europe and elsewhere, to develop a kind of local face. And it's not just an argument, it's actually happening more and more, and it's happening very much in the food world. You mentioned farmers markets, which have just exploded across the United States and Northern Europe. They've always existed in Southern Europe, of course, where they do slow food and food and just without even thinking about it. But in the kind of English-speaking world, we seem to have embraced and rediscovered the joys of shopping locally, enjoying food that, food that has a story behind it, food that tastes of something, food that hasn't ravaged the environment to get to our plate, and just the pleasure of walking or cycling to a local market and seeing other people that you know and getting to know the people who give you your food. And these things all contribute to quality of life. They're very hard to measure on a graph or on a spreadsheet, and maybe they don't appear always in the GDP figures for a nation's output, but they are at the core of what quality of life is. You know, that's, we are human beings are social animals, and any kind of social exchange, any kind of social interaction, is going to make us happier. It's going to make us healthier, and ultimately, of course, it'll make us more productive when we go to work at the end of the day or the beginning of the day. So there's a, you know, there are a lot of benefits to be harvested from going local, and I think you see more and more of it. And I mean, California is on the cutting edge of a lot of that farmers market stuff. And what one of the criticisms people sometimes make of it is that, oh, well, that's, you know, tomatoes are, you know, about however many dollars a pound. It's all very expensive. It's for the elites. And there's, to some extent, that is sometimes true. But often in farmers markets, you find, you know, that the price differential isn't that great. And the quality that you get is so much more. And if you look at the recent figures on how much food we throw away, I think I saw recently that certainly in England, I think it's not that different from the United States, that people are throwing away up to 40% of the food shopping that they buy in an average month. And that's a huge amount because we have speed. Fast consumption ultimately is a false economy. You know, you go to a big supermarket, you get a big family pack of tomatoes or oranges or whatever, and then it sits at the bottom of the fridge and you don't eat half of it.
You should never put tomatoes in the fridge.
It
destroys them immediately. I'm becoming something of an expert here because I'm growing my own tomatoes. And I do them in these big pots on the back patio. And, of course, it costs a fortune. They're the world's most expensive tomatoes, but they're worth it. Because
they're probably the world's best, though.
They taste so good. I'm also growing passion fruit as well. So you said earlier, Carl Honoré, that quite often it takes some kind of apocalyptic event for people to wake up and start to slow down and smell the roses, you know. And we had this phony apocalypse with Carmageddon, which, thanks to the hype of the media, turned out to keep everybody off the roads, and people had a great time at home, and they reinvented themselves if they didn't even realize it. Now, I recall also after 9/11, when the aircraft was shut down, how quiet it was and how different it was. But I think in terms of the apocalypse, if you will, a lot of indications from scientists about global warming that we are indeed facing an environmental apocalypse. So how does this tie into your slowness thing? In other words, can this be a roadmap? Because arguments over carbon taxes and all of this stuff that we're trying to do to address global warming politically is not working. And as you know, the U.S. opted out of Kyoto. It's not working at a political level, the awareness about what's happening. So to me, it has to work at a human level. People have to change the way they live because the politicians are so bankrupt and so in the pocket of the oil companies and the powerful interests. I don't think it's going to happen unless the people lead.
I think that's true. I think we've reached a stage where this has to bubble up from the grassroots, from the bottom up. And it seems to me that the slow creed or the slow philosophy is a very useful lever for getting people to think about how they can live differently in a way that doesn't lay waste to Mother Nature. I mean, there's whatever you think about carbon, global warming and carbon, this, that, and the other. What is indisputable is that the Earth cannot sustain 7, 8, 9, 10 billion people consuming at the rate that the average American consumer consumes today. That's a fact. whatever lobby you belong to, whatever think tank is funding you, that is just a fact. That is just not going to happen. So we need now to be thinking quite seriously about consuming in different ways. And I think part of the problem with much of the green approach, the green movement, the ecological eco lobby, is that it often has a slightly hectoring, lecturing tone, finger wagging and so on. And you can see why that happens, and maybe there's some room for hectoring and finger wagging. But I think that often turns people off. And that what I think is quite hopeful and upbeat about the slow movement is it's saying, okay, hang on a minute, let's turn the coin around, let's turn the argument around and say, well, what do we really want? You know, what would make people happy? What would make people well? What would actually make us, better workers as well in the long run? And that's slowing down, having a good quality of life, enjoying every moment, rather than turning every moment into a race against the clock, savoring the minutes instead of counting them. And if you come in sort of through that door, it can lead you to the same place, which is a different kind of consumption, a different approach to capitalism, a different approach to consumerism. But it comes in through a different door, and a door that I think people find much more approachable. And that may be the lever. That may be the way to push forward, because it does feel like we are in a kind of intellectual gridlock at the moment with the whether it's politicians or business, big business all in one corner, and the environmental lobby in another, and people hurling insults across the chasm and questioning each other's reports and facts and figures. And it just feels like a kind of shouting match in an echo chamber. And I think that's really off-putting. And maybe this sort of thinking about slowing down and doing things better and enjoying life more is a way in that's approachable to all sides and something that maybe gets away from the traditional right-left divides and some of the old slugging matches of the past.
Well, I think also it would apply to economics and the kind of corporate mentality, if you will, where there's endless books about how to improve the bottom line. But the bottom line is that if your workers are happier and more rested, they're more productive. So maybe corporations should discover the slow movement too.
Exactly, and they are. In fact, when my book first came out, I thought that I would be eviscerated by the corporate world, that it would be just blood on the floor and I would be crucified. But actually the opposite has turned out to be true, because people who are in the, especially the fast-moving industries, the most demanding, the most high-stress, the most high-powered sectors of the economy, these are the people who are on the front line. These are the people who know more than anyone else the damage that too much speed, too much busyness, constant distraction, and overstimulation is doing, not only to their health and private lives, but also to their ability to work well. So you're finding out big companies all over the world, even in the United States, you know, which, as you were saying earlier, is famous for its workaholic hour culture. I mean, big companies like Boston Consulting Group and so on, offering its staff more vacation time and at the same time insisting that they take it, you know, result, staff who are happier, healthier, more productive, who make fewer mistakes. Or big high-tech companies suggesting now that we use the off button on our smartphones and our internet connection so that we can put on the brakes a little bit, so we can rest, reflect, recharge. You know, Hewlett-Packard put out some research a little while ago warning that the constant barrage of electronic interruptions, phone, fax, pager, tweet, email, causes our IQ to fall 10 points. And if you know anything about IQ,
I certainly know that that's the last thing we need in America is for people to get stupider, because
smoking
I'm
marijuana
afraid it's already happening.
Or smoking a joint. So you, on one hand, we have this idea that being always on, being constantly connected, answering every phone call in the first ring, is going to turn you into an uber-productive master of the universe, when in fact it's going to turn you into Cheech and Chong. You know, that's Hewlett-Packard saying, off your mobile phones. It's not an aromatherapy cooperative. So I think you know, that's another sign that the tectonic plates are moving below the surface, that even business is starting to say, whoa, things are too fast. You know, it's actually harming the bottom line, and we could goose the bottom line by slowing down judiciously just a little bit at the right moments.
Well, let's hope that people in Los Angeles and perhaps in the rest of the world learn from Carmageddon for this last weekend. And already the city of Bogota shuts its streets down on a Sunday, and people get to enjoy their city.
I was in Bogota last month, and I'll tell you, it's extraordinary. I mean, it feels like the natural order somehow has been restored. People come out, they talk to their neighbors, they cycle, children play, and it's remarkable. It's like a kind of scene from a medieval painting, and it's actually joyous. And Bogota is a pretty chaotic, messy, anarchic city in the developing world. If Bogota can pull something like that off, then why not Los Angeles?
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us today, Carl Honoré.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Carl Honoré, author of the book In Praise of Slowness, Our Worldwide Movement is Challenging the Cult of Speed. His most recent book is Under Pressure, Rescuing Our Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting. He also blogs at carlhonore.com. That's carlhonore.com. So what do we learn today on Background Briefing? Well, we began talking with Robert Kuttner, who worked for the legendary I.F. Stone. He was a 20-year columnist with Business Week, worked as a chief investigator for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee. Basically, I was asking him about this economic hostage crisis situation in Washington, D.C., and how come the Republicans are using the threat of economic collapse to extort concessions from a president who has to run for re-election on a weak economy. They're weakening even further. And, of course, that's the real question of why isn't the press talking about this? It's so obvious, the extortion that's going on. He agreed that this was the main problem, but on the other hand, he said that, you know, unless the worst thing that could happen would be for the Republicans to agree to the deal that Obama offered, which apparently was on the table, the $4 trillion in cuts, decimating Social Security and Medicare, and basically destroying the legacy of the Democratic Party.
apparently that was on the table. I don't know what the proof is, but that's what everybody's saying. And the worst possible thing would be for the Republicans to suddenly get some sanity and stop this extortion and say, okay, the Democrats agree to this. How could the Democrats run in 2012 with that kind of, with the Republicans saying, you guys were prepared to give away the store? So it is, if that's true, it is really a hideous concession. Of course, the conventional wisdom is that Obama was just, you know, positioning himself as a centrist. But, you know, let's hope that's off the table and never to return. But he was really quite depressed. I mean, everybody is, I guess, about Obama's negotiating strategy and his apparent zeal to be a centrist and continually gets nothing in return for it. Which is, in effect, the theme of the second interview with Dr. Marvin Weinbaum, formerly with the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence, about, you know, the U.S. And I guess to some extent Karzai in Afghanistan keep thinking that somehow they can negotiate with the Taliban. He thinks that the Taliban are out assassinating all these people, including a very close aide of Karzai's, not to mention his crooked drug-dealing brother the other day. Is that the Taliban are out killing these high officials because they don't want to negotiate. They don't see why they should negotiate. They have an expression: "You have the watches, we have the time." And he's quite serious in suggesting that that this is a delusion on the part of the U.S. that somehow you can negotiate and have a negotiated withdrawal. We're having a withdrawal, but what we leave behind may be pretty ugly, and that these people truly hate each other in a way that was illustrated by the footage that came out today of the Taliban executing 16 Pakistani policemen. Then we talked about Carmageddon that didn't happen, all of this hysteria that in fact brought us these beautiful clear skies and quiet, you could hear the birds, and people were hanging out with their families. And I guess I asked the question, why don't we do this every day? Why don't they close the freeways and blow up bridges? Because this was really an interesting paradoxical lesson that we got out of this thing. So I had the godfather of the slow movement on, Karl Honoré, and he was really so articulate and so interesting the way he talked. It was absolutely fascinating to hear somebody with such clear and concise explanations of why it is all of us have to get off this incredible industrial capitalist treadmill. So that was quite a pleasure, and that was today's program. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. You can sign up for podcasts and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.